The views and opinions expressed by the guests of the Inspira podcast do not necessarily represent the official policy or position of any agency of the United States government or any organization, public or private.
One, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Inspira podcast, hosted by your girl, me, Erica Mueller Chen. I'm an international development specialist with over a decade of experience leveraging the amazing power of sport to promote peace and positive social impact. My career has allowed me to live in Europe, Southern Africa, and Latin America. In 2022, I accepted an offer for my dream job in sports diplomacy. And I also became an employee family member to a U.S. diplomat, aka an EFM. This podcast is all about inspiration and career advice. Each episode, I'll interview an inspirational global changemaker working in sport for development, social impact, or the diplomatic service. This series is perfect if you have interest in breaking into one of these sectors. Or you've already landed that dream role and are keen to learn from thought leaders. Enjoy today's episode and stay inspired.
How we grow the football for good sector, and actually beyond that, how do we make sport and football in general purpose driven? And to create that vision, we thought it couldn't just be the two of us putting forward our ideas. It needed to be wider than that. So we had this concept of the Radical 11 and inviting 11 people from around the world from different roles within the football ecosystem to put forward their ideas on a vision for the football industry and how we can make it purpose driven.
Welcome, friends. Today's special guest is Steve Fleming. Steve is the co-founder of Kick for Life FC, a multi-award-winning charity, social enterprise, and football club based in Lesotho in Southern Africa. Kick for Life delivers a range of football for good interventions for children and young people, covering health, education, gender, and climate action, as well as providing structured training and employment opportunities for hundreds of young people via its hospitality enterprises. The organization's academy program also supports vulnerable youth with progression to scholarships at international universities, alongside developing young players for Lesotho's national squads, with Kick for Life Women becoming national champions in 2021. Steve is also the author of two books. One is called 11, Stories of Development Through Football, published in 2010 and shortlisted for the Peace and Sport Special Jury Prize, and more recently, Radical Football, published in 2022. Steve was named in the Beyond Sport Inspirational 50 in 2015. Welcome, Steve. You've got a lot going on there. I'm excited to learn more about your journey. How are you and where are you calling us from?
Hey, Erica. Yeah, great to be here. I'm in the UK in a small village called Little Paxton in Cambridgeshire. And I've just been out for a run and we're coming into spring here. So yeah, it's coming to life every day, which is nice.
Wonderful. Well, it's good to be catching up with you. And I like to start with at least one reason why my guest inspires me. And Steve, you've been on my radar for a long time because I remember learning about you and your brother co-founding Kick for Life. And whether that was just me early in the days of learning about the sector or whether it was actually true, I believe you and him were the first of really building an organization during this time when sport for social change was becoming a thing in the world. And so I just remember that really clearly. And I think I connected with both of you back in the day, just trying to understand more about the sector. And since then, you and the organization have certainly achieved a lot, as I mentioned from some of those points just a moment ago. And in addition to that organizational success, I think the books are also an incredible resource, an incredible storytelling for the sector. Because as you and I can probably agree, when we learn things, when we experience things, it's really hard to share that with others or package it in a way where they can really imagine what it was like. And so I feel like you've done an incredible job with that, especially through Radical Football.
Oh, thank you very much. And yeah, obviously we connected back in the early days. I think it was probably sort of 2009, 2010. And so yeah, a lot to catch up on.
Perhaps I can invite you to share with the audience a little bit more about your career sports journey.
Yeah, so well, I'd actually call it kind of a life and career sports journey because the two are pretty inextricably linked, really. And it goes back to my earliest days growing up in the UK and being mad on sports as a participant and as a fan, into football particularly, but also athletics, tennis, anything going really I was into. And I guess that was the foundation for my later progression into a career in sport for development. But it didn't happen directly. And after university, I went into doing a number of jobs in marketing, in government. And I was going on, I guess, a career path that was okay, but it didn't really inspire me greatly. And in the midst of that, when I was about mid to late 20s, I came up with this mad idea to dribble a football across Africa. And I got my brother Pete involved. He's a bit younger than me, but he was up for it. And together we came up with this plan to dribble a ball for 250 miles across Malawi in Africa, to raise funds for a project working with children who'd been orphaned by HIV/AIDS. And at the time, it was intended as a one-off fundraiser. But I think probably somewhere in the back of our mind, we thought that it might turn into something bigger, and it certainly did. And the experience we had out there, seeing how the kids particularly responded to just this exercise of dribbling a football through their community, created such a lot of excitement and engagement that before we came back to the UK, we knew that this was going to be the start of a longer journey. And that's really the origins of Kick for Life. And it grew from there.
Wow. Every time I hear you tell that story, I'm just taken aback because it's an incredible idea. It must have been an incredible experience. And then it set you up on this incredible path. And so I'd love to know more about why Lesotho and some of those earlier steps of making that idea and that inspiration, putting it in action.
Yeah, so that first challenge that we did was in Malawi. But when we started to think about Kick for Life and what we were going to do and where we were going to work, we literally got out a map of Africa and started to look at it and think, well, where could we go that hasn't already got a strong sport for development presence as a startup organization, as somewhere we could go that we'd be the first to do it, somewhere where we'd be able to communicate in English, and somewhere where there was a need. And we wrote off to five or six of FAs on the continent, and only one replied, and that was Lesotho. And they said, we've never heard of this idea, sport for development, but we'd love you to come out and work with us. So Pete went out on a trip, a research trip for a few weeks, and got a great feel for the potential there, and a great response again from some of the people in the country. And on the back of that, we started then to apply for some funding and eventually got a startup grant from the Vodafone Foundation, which was enough for Pete to then move out there and get started and get underway with our project, which was focused on using football to deliver health education. And we had a really amazing first even 6 months out there, where we had a couple of lucky moments connected to the 2010 World Cup that gave us a really great start. The first one was, so we partnered with Grassroots Soccer initially, and they worked with us sharing their curriculum, and we adapted it to Lesotho and the particular needs there around HIV prevention, education and access to testing. But we built a couple of really good relationships. The first one through the Vodafone Foundation, we had a connection to Prince Harry, who had done a gap year in Lesotho in 2004, a few years earlier. And on the back of that, he came out and was a really great supporter of Kick for Life and attended some of our events. But also the New England coach at the time, Fabio Capello, he came out to Lesotho and brought with him about 40 members of the senior British press, as in they wanted him to spend some time with the press to get to know them and build a relationship ahead of the 2010 World Cup. And they happened to pick our event. So we'd only been going for 6 months. A small, very small charity, and suddenly we had the England coach and all this press attention, and it was incredible. And Capello was very moved by the experience he had there. He told the press it was the most moving experience he'd had in 40 years in the football industry, and it went big in the newspapers. And on the back of that, we were able to build new relationships and partnerships, and it really sent us into a direction that we hadn't expected in terms of the growth of the charity.
And that's what I was going to ask is, did you expect that attention? And what do you think helped you? I know you mentioned having a little bit of luck, but what do you think helped you get Vodafone, get Prince Harry, get these corporate alignments and the press?
Yeah, well, it's definitely a helping of luck and the timing around the World Cup. But I think something to do as well with our energy and enthusiasm probably played a part. We were so passionate, we remained so passionate, but we'd thrown ourselves wholeheartedly into the setting up of Kick for Life. And I think hopefully that was infectious. And some of the people that we were having conversations with felt that as well. And that led to a few doors being opened that we hadn't expected. And also, I think also the quality of the work we're doing on the ground, I hope as well. And the work we're doing around HIV education and the testing programs that we were doing were already by then showing some good results. So that certainly helped as well.
Nice. And before you started Kick for Life, how much of an understanding did you have of sport for development?
Yeah, very basic. We didn't really think of it as there being like a sector of sport for development. We obviously researched it online and we found a few examples of things that have been done. We came across Street Football World as something that caught our attention even back then. But in terms of some of the structures of sport for development, very basic and quite naive understanding. But we had an intrinsic belief at that point, a belief that sport could make a difference. And that's obviously grown and developed over the years into a knowledge that sport can make a difference.
Nice, nice. Well, thanks for sharing a little bit about that founder's journey. And the one other thing I want to ask about Kick for Life specifically before I ask about your insights and your wisdom even more is how the organization has evolved over the last decade. Because from my outsider viewpoint, I understand that the organization has introduced some really innovative social enterprise initiatives such as a restaurant and hospitality and a football club and just all of these things that I'm curious how they came to be and kind of the ecosystem of Kick for Life and the programming.
Yeah, we've definitely gone in directions that could never have been anticipated at the start or expected. And if you told me that we'd be running a restaurant and a hotel and conference center, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But yeah, so I'll go back to that beginning point where we were out in Lesotho delivering just a health education program around HIV AIDS. And from there, we certainly grew to a wider, more holistic focus. And I think that came from learning about the complex needs of the children and young people we were working with. So Lesotho does have the second highest HIV prevalence in the world at 23.2%. But the needs and challenges of young people are much more complicated than that. They relate to education, to nutrition, to mental well-being, etc. So we started to develop programming that was more holistic in nature. We also recognized the funding challenges that many sport for development organizations face. And I said again at the beginning, we had that one grant from Vodafone, and we knew immediately that that was great to have it, but it wasn't going to be there forever. And it wasn't, we needed to diversify our funding sources. So we started to build more grant-based relationships. We got some funding from UNICEF, from GIZ, etc. And we started to build our fundraising activities as well. But we also saw that social enterprise could be another possibility. And at the time, I can't even remember if we knew it was called social enterprise, but this idea of being able to generate some of our own income that would give us greater independence and flexibility was quite exciting. And again, we were a bit lucky with the 2010 World Cup in that FIFA had a scheme called 20 Centres for 2010, where they built 20 facilities across Africa that had a health and education building and a five-a-side pitch. And we were selected to host one in Lesotho. And we managed to secure a piece of land in the centre of Maseru, the capital city, that had more potential than just that basic centre. And around the World Cup, we were able to leverage additional support to create a number of new businesses. And we'd identified hospitality as an area where it's quite a good fit with some of our skills and also a market opportunity. And over the coming years, it took a long time, was a massive learning curve. We worked towards opening a restaurant and a small hotel and conference center that are now one of the top facilities in the whole of Lesotho. And two drivers really. And the first driver was that financial component of generating income that would sustain us. And they now contribute about 25% of our income. Yes. But also the other driver was providing some progression routes for our participants. So we were working with these young people, but they were coming out at 16, 17, 18 and entering a world with very few opportunities and with very high youth unemployment. So we thought that our enterprises could be a progression route for them to move into structured training and employment opportunities. And that's been the case ever since.
Nice. Well, it actually makes me think about the organization I worked for in the Western Cape of South Africa, because it was a unique model as well, linked to hospitality, because the nonprofit was a subsidiary of a 5-star nature reserve. And so you had all of these international people and international attention going to this nature reserve, not only for the resort, but also for the unique location. And then saying, oh, there's also this nonprofit arm and it happens to be sport. And through that structure, the organization was able to create a lot of innovative and quality leadership programs, including how to become a nature guide, all of these things that I don't think you can really replicate, but it works. And so to that point, do you think what you all have done in Lesotho could be done in other countries? If someone listening is like, oh, I really want to build an NGO, and you know, hopefully they've done loads of research, but are there any pieces of that that you think are universal, or is it all so specific to that location?
No, I think the concept of social enterprise and income generation is very transferable. And it doesn't have to be something as kind of sophisticated as a restaurant or complicated as a restaurant. It can be a very basic way of generating income as a starting point. And actually, we've been working with a number of other projects around the world within Sport for Development to help them on that path to setting up their own businesses. And I think it's increasingly important as well as the funding environment becomes more competitive and more challenging with some of the economic developments and cost challenges that the organizations diversify their income streams. And if you can have a portion of your income which is quite predictable but also flexible, and that you can apply to some of those costs that maybe funders don't always want to cover, then it can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, thanks for that. So in terms of funding, Steve, you mentioned some really interesting things about diversifying the funding streams and having a little bit of predictability, which is quite challenging in the nonprofit space. And so I know we're talking about social enterprise here. I'm curious your insights on social enterprise and its potential for empowering Sport for Good organizations as something that I think you refer to as a balanced fundraising approach.
Yeah, so I talked about it a bit already, the evolution of our funding model, how we moved from having one grant to having a few grants and some fundraising activities, and then alongside that to having our income generating activities. And I think what it gives you is more security as an organization in terms of your financing. So if you lose one grant that's you've had for a number of years, that suddenly goes, then the organization doesn't collapse, or the program doesn't have to collapse either. So it gives you that greater security. And a good example, I think, was the pandemic as well, when we'd had the social enterprises that we'd built up really well, and they were contributing significantly to the organization. And then suddenly, actually, they were the funding source that dried up, because overnight we had to close the businesses. And we went from having two thriving businesses to having zero income and still having the staff that we had before, but no government support scheme. So that was a big challenge. But at the same time, we also had good grant support, good fundraising support. So that was there to plug some of those gaps. Since, obviously, the enterprises have reopened and doing fantastically well, which is great. But it shows just an example of how that balanced fundraising situation can or position can support the organization through difficult times.
And do you feel like you and Pete's connection internationally helped?
I think the nature of our supporter network is global for sure. We've got partnerships in the UK and a lot of supporters in the UK and also in the USA. So yeah, being able to extend our fundraising beyond Lesotho is really important. We have grants that are sourced within country. And we have grants that are sourced via kind of our registered entity in the UK as well. So yeah, for sure.
Quick break here with a special message from your host. This episode is being released in celebration of the United Nations recognized International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, which takes place annually on April 6th. Each year, champions of the sport for development sector use this day to raise awareness of the incredible work that individuals and organizations are leading across the globe to leverage the potential power of sport and play to drive tangible impact and positive social change. I hope that listeners, whether an enthusiast, a skeptic, or a novice in this space, that you find the conversations I facilitate on the Inspira podcast to be informative and inspirational. If you enjoy this podcast, you would be a rock star if you went ahead and gave it a 5-star review with a complimentary written sentence or two on Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast platform. Enjoy listening, and happy April 6th, everybody. 3, 2, 1, yeah. I'm also wondering about your insights in terms of just building this organization. And so something that you've described to me is the organizational identity in the sector and the importance of finding and evolving your position in this growing space. I'd love to know more about what that means to you and why that was really valuable.
Yeah, I mean, I think identity for any organization is important. And as the sport for development sector grows and becomes more competitive, there's more organizations in the space, then it's increasingly important that your organization is able to differentiate and stand out in that crowd. Obviously, we're really pleased that it's growing. It's evidence that sport for good works. And there's still loads of space for more organizations to emerge. But at the same time, you want to make sure that you kind of stand out in a crowded space. So going back again to when we first set up, we weren't thinking too strategically about our identity, but it kind of happened organically. And I picked out a number of areas where I think we had an identity. Firstly, geographically, I mentioned that we picked Lesotho partly because there was nothing else happening there. And we have become synonymous with Lesotho, which has been a real positive for us. So for example, when we go for funding applications, in sport for development, you might have 15 to 20 organizations from South Africa going for it, but only one or two from Lesotho. So immediately it gives you a bit of an identity. And thematically as well, at the beginning, we were very focused on HIV/AIDS. And I think everybody knew us for that well beyond actually when it was our primary focus. And then obviously sport, our identity was football. And there we didn't stand out. I think certainly the largest number of sport for development organizations are focused on football, but we had those other areas where we did stand out, and in terms of our methodology and our approach as well was quite cutting edge. So that was our starting identity, but it's evolved since then. And it's been a process to kind of communicate to our stakeholders and audiences that that's happened and that it is happening and why it's happening. And I think certainly the location has stayed the same. We've stayed focused on Lesotho. There's been opportunities for us to go elsewhere, but we've always decided that our primary focus should be on working in Lesotho, and football stayed the same. It wouldn't make sense for us to change that. That's the most popular sport in Lesotho. It's the way that we can be most effective. But as I mentioned, our focus programmatically has evolved as we recognized that we needed to be more holistic. So we've moved into other areas such as gender and employability, and more recently, climate action. And then we've also had new identities that have emerged. So we talked about the social enterprises. I think now we're probably more known for our pioneering work in that area than we are for HIV/AIDS. And also the football club identity that we talked about, becoming a football club dedicated to social change. And again, at the beginning, we never thought that we would have an elite component to the organization. In fact, we deliberately tried to stop it, but because of, we were worried about how that would be perceived by others within the charitable arena. But as our teams kind of formed themselves and started to play in the leagues, we started to see that it could be a really positive thing in terms of engagement, in terms of empowering young people, in terms of breaking down gender stereotypes through our women's team. So we decided to embrace it, and being a football club became a massive part of our identity and something that's provided opportunities for us to grow as an organization. And then in 2021, our women's team, as you mentioned at the beginning, became national champions. So that's been part of our identity. So yeah, it's been a real process of bringing people with us as we go, making sure our stakeholders understand. So that's our staff, our participants, our funders, that when we're talking to them, they understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how it's going to make a difference.
Thanks so much for those insights. And I'm thinking more about what you just said about providing that elite sports offering and how at first you tried to stop it a little bit, I think you said. And what advice might you give to other organizations out there who are maybe feeling that tension in some way, where maybe there is an appetite, usually there is, for performing to win and practicing to improve? How can an organization kind of assess if that makes sense for them, if they are intending to be a social change oriented organization?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and one that we continually address in the organization to make sure we have the correct balance. And the vast majority of the programs that we do are focused on inclusion of everybody on a level playing field. So all of our programs that focus on health education are fully inclusive, and there's sometimes there's a competitive element, but it's not about who wins. It's about what you can learn and share with each other. But there's a clear separation within the organization of where there is any kind of elite component of it, and a clear separation in terms of activities and also in terms of finances as well. So we can ensure that the grants and funding is being used in accordance with how it should be. So I think having that clear separation is the one piece of advice I would pick out and say is the most important thing to have in mind. And also, in addition to that, why are you doing the elite part? I think just doing it because it's fun is probably not a good enough reason in itself. But if it's serving the purpose of social change, which is why we decided to do it, if it's furthering your social mission, if it's opening up new opportunities for participants or enabling you to reach more people or to generate income that has an end goal of social impact, that's a reason why we would recommend doing it.
Thanks for that. And it does sound like you really took the community's input into consideration. And also you've mentioned growing holistically a few times. And my question there is just how much time was involved in making each of those big decisions, or what I would feel as a big decision. So whether it was opening the restaurant, starting the elite club, kind of like those potential expansions to what you were doing, were those things that you kind of tested out to feel it out? Or was it like, okay, we're doing this, this is going to be the 3-year plan?
Yeah, looking back, it's really interesting to try and understand and pick out how it happened and what happened. But I think we've always been collaborative in the way we've done things. So it's not been a case of us deciding, or Pete and I deciding, this is what we're doing. It's engaging people, listening to the ideas of other people. I think the idea for the restaurant first came from somewhere else in the organization. And then going through it together, that change process has not always been easy. So going from a kind of traditional sport for development organization to telling people we're going to open a restaurant and then going on that journey has been a real exercise in change management. It's not always easy, but I think if you get that initial buy-in from key people within the organization, then you can make it succeed. And I think there's a question as well about what do people in Lesotho think of Pete and I? And we've always been conscious that we're of white savior syndrome and the idea that we're parachuting in to save the country, which I think in the early days, maybe we're a bit naive and maybe there was a little bit of that there, but always with an understanding that we wanted to empower local people if we could to be the change makers. And that's definitely the way it is. And as the organization has grown, we're now, our entire senior management team and team on the ground is locally led, which is what we've always been working towards.
And I've heard compliments about that evolution from other people you probably don't even know, saying like, okay, Kick for Life started out with Pete and Steve, and now it's really owned and led and represented by community members, which is the hope, but it doesn't always happen. I'm wondering about the climate action piece, because that is certainly very important and perhaps a little bit underdeveloped in this development sector, and especially the relationship between how sport can address climate change is a huge, huge topic. And so are there any insights you can share there about what you've learned about the interaction between sport and climate action, or the potential for NGOs to address that?
Yeah, as you say, a huge topic. And already we're starting to see some of the impacts of climate change in Lesotho, particularly on kind of vulnerable communities. So extended droughts, and where that happens, it's the most vulnerable people who are affected the most in terms of things like food security. And there's a higher incidence of girls going into sex work in communities that are most affected by climate change and things like that. So what we're trying to do is really just build some awareness through sport amongst our participants to say, these are the issues. And this is start to think about some ways that communities can take action to address them. But I think, yeah, sport for development definitely has a role to play. The sport industry has a much bigger role to play, and that's really where we need to see the biggest changes taking place. And it's great to see some organizations like Football for Future who are really doing that role of trying to challenge the sport industry to be more responsible and more dynamic in their approach to climate action.
Really important work. And one thing we haven't talked about yet, which I know you're heavily involved in, is the Kick for Life Assist program. And so I understand that you lead the organization's training and consultancy service called Kick for Life Assist, variously delivering organizational strategy, coach training, curriculum design, and social enterprise all over the world. And so I'd love to know more about that work in capacity building other organizations.
We've made the strategic decision to focus exclusively on Lesotho in terms of our main work. But at the same time, we've always been an outward looking organization. We've always wanted to be a part of a bigger community and ecosystem. And that's where Kick for Life Assist comes in. And really, it's another social enterprise as well, as a way of generating income to support our work in Lesotho. But I guess we reached a point after operating for maybe 10 to 15 years where we felt we had some useful skills and experience that could be shared with other organizations around the world. And that's the origins of Kick for Life Assist. And we've since had the opportunity to partner with some amazing projects in many different places. So a few examples, we worked with UEFA Foundation and the International Trade Center to create a curriculum called Kick for Trade. And we trained coaches in the Gambia and Guinea and more recently in Iraq as well. We've also created a cricket-based curriculum for Chance to Shine, which is a charity in the UK using cricket to engage young people in personal development and life skills. We've done work with Generation Amazing, led coaching courses in Pakistan and Qatar. Slightly different, we've done a lot of social enterprise development work. So using our experience that we have in Lesotho of creating enterprises, we've done a lot of work in Africa. And we worked with a project called Open Field in Cameroon, and they're now running an equipment rental business, renting out their sports equipment and event equipment when they're not using it for their programs and generating income. And another great charity called VAP in Kenya, who have set up a restaurant on the back of hearing about the work we did in Lesotho. And we've been coaching and mentoring them on their journey as well. And then finally, some organizational development support for a charity called Play It Forward in the UK and Zambia. So kind of helping them on their journey towards being a football club in the same way that we progressed as well. And it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed this element of what we do and supporting the growth of sport for good around the world.
That's incredible. You have had quite a journey, and I'm just thinking about the impact in all of those different places and all of those different organizations is really something special. And Steve, I'm wondering what you've learned from doing that Kick for Life Assist work. I recognize in our conversation, you've already mentioned so many pillars of what can lead to success, whether it's having an organizational identity, growing holistically, diversifying funding streams, the list goes on. And so from Kick for Life Assist, did you ever find yourself kind of repeating the same advice, regardless of location, or just the way you went about those interactions to capacity building? What did you learn from that might be helpful to people working in the sector?
Yeah, I think the first thing I learned is that I'm definitely not always the best person to provide the consulting, and that we need to draw on other expertise and specialism within Kick for Life. So for the coach training, we definitely engage our expert coaches in Lesotho. And it's been really refreshing to see young leaders from the South going up to other parts of the world to show the leadership. But I'd say that two of the big learnings, so I've talked about what we've done around sport for development and around social enterprise. And I think the principles are quite similar wherever you go. So the principles of sport for development as a tool for engagement and delivery, they tend to work everywhere. And the principles of business, obviously, as well, are pretty consistent. But what you do need to think about is how they're applied, the environment and the culture, and understanding the culture of where you go to implement has been the biggest learning curve. So I talked about Kick for Trade. We've delivered that in the Gambia in West Africa, and we've delivered it in Iraq, two very different places. And although the methodology hasn't actually changed very much at all, the way it's delivered and the messaging has had to be adapted.
Have you had any experiences where sport just doesn't work?
I can't think of any examples of where we've tried it and people haven't responded well. No.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I would say that.
Awesome. Well, anything else before we kind of talk about radical football? Anything from Kick for Life or your learnings or experiences that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, so just when I was talking about identity, I was talking about individual organizational identity. And I just wanted to emphasize that that doesn't mean we don't care about being part of a bigger community of organizations as well. And I think I'd like to think that part of our identity at Kick for Life is being an organization that is committed to being open and collaborative with others as well. And just thinking about communities of people, when there's diverse representation of different types of people, communities are effective. And I think it goes the same for the sport development sector. We don't want every organization to be the same. We want lots of different contributions while at the same time recognizing we're part of the same whole ecosystem.
Kick for Life right now, about how many staff are employed or involved, about how many program participants you're usually interacting with, kind of what's the reach at the moment? And I acknowledge numbers aren't everything, but I just wanted to ask if you have any available.
Sure. Yeah. So we've got approximately 40 staff at the moment. That's across our charitable operations and our social enterprises. And on top of that, we have volunteers as well in country, in Lesotho. The number of participants that we reach, probably I'd say averages around about 2,500 a year. Some of those are people who are engaged in community programs where they attend maybe a 12-week course covering different topics. Others are engaged on a longer term basis through kind of more holistic support as well.
Do you have any favorite moments from your work?
So many great moments, but the one that continues to stand out was the opening of our center in September 2011, where we hadn't had, prior to that, we hadn't had a facility and our staff had been in a small office. And now we had this amazing place and we had the attention of the world for a brief moment. And yeah, an incredibly moving moment on the pitch where all of our staff came together. We were all singing and celebrating that moment. It was very special.
Well, if anyone's listening out there and they want to get involved either in the Kick for Life Assist program or just to learn more about what you all do, are there any specific opportunities or ways that they can collaborate with you or learn from you?
Yeah, so both. Yeah, we're always looking for new partners to collaborate with on our work in Lesotho, new organizations to support around the world through Kick for Life Assist, and other opportunities to learn and share. Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. Well, the next thing that we're going to get into is radical football, which is, from what I understand, this very related concept, but in a different format. So really taking shape in this written book that you've created. And I'd love to invite you to share more with the audience about the inspiration behind radical football and a little bit more just about the process of putting it together.
Yeah, so I think it probably goes back to the pandemic. And I think that reawakened something in me that wanted to write another book. So I did the first one back in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then it was quite a big gap before thinking about writing another book. And I felt that I wanted to do another creative project personally and also professionally. I thought it made sense for us to partly through it tell the Kick for Life story and the wider story of football for good and sport for good as a whole. And so The full title of the book is Radical Football, Jürgen Griesbeck and the Story of Football for Good. And many of the listeners will be aware of who Jürgen is. And he's been kind of a leader in the Football for Good community for many years now. And I've always thought his story was fascinating, motivating and something that should be told. So I approached him and just sent him an email, said, would you be interested in going through this exercise together of telling your story and see what happens? And he responded positively. And we just went from there. We had a call once a week on a Thursday where we started at the beginning, and he told me about his story in Colombia setting up Football for Peace, and then how that led into Street Football World and then subsequently Common Goal. So it came together quite quickly, and it wasn't intended, but the second half of that book then turned into telling the Kick for Life story. So an example of one organization within that community and how that grew in parallel with the wider Common Goal movement. And yeah, so the book came out at the beginning of 2022, and yeah, it seems to have been well received, which is very nice.
Was there anything that surprised you from your weekly calls with Jürgen and his insights and experiences? Anything you weren't expecting?
I can't think of anything specific, but it was the opportunity, I think, to interview lots of other people as well that was made it a really colourful experience. So it was great going through Jürgen's story. But then as we went through it, other people came into that story as well. So I interviewed probably 20, 25 other people in that whole process. And just seeing the different ways that everybody chipped in to make it a collective effort was really interesting. And you know, contributions from all over the world, as we had stories from Serbia, from India, from the USA, from Africa, all coming together into this one story of football being used as a tool for social change.
That's so cool. Yeah, you're making me think, Steve, just about if I should do something with my Inspira guests, and just
yeah, why not?
I can imagine that, you know, taking myself out of the conversation, that there's just this incredible potential and untapped opportunity of storytelling, and also putting these stories on paper or even in film about the sport for social change sector, which is one small reason why me back in the conversation, why I'm having these conversations, because I want to hear the stories. I want to help tell the stories. So yeah, I think that's an incredible idea you had. And it sounds like it came together quite quickly, which had to feel good too.
Yeah, I think it was important that we did it in that way as well. Otherwise, yeah, it could have dragged on for ages. I talked about the first half and the second half. So the first half was Jürgen's story of setting up a project in Colombia and then Street Football World. The second half was that continued story in parallel with Kick for Life. But then we also ended up doing a third half as well, which kind of relates to the methodology
that sounds familiar.
some curricula in Football for Good. But that third half was looking to the future. So the first two were looking to the past. This one was looking to the future and how we grow the Football for Good sector, and actually beyond that, how do we make sport and football in general purpose driven? And to create that vision, we thought it couldn't just be the two of us putting forward our ideas. It needed to be wider than that. So we had this concept of the Radical 11, and inviting 11 people from around the world from different roles within the football ecosystem to put forward their ideas on a vision for the football industry and how we can make it purpose driven. And we ended up getting 11 absolutely wonderful contributions that have collectively come together to create this powerful message about how we can radically transform sport and football in particular to fulfill its potential as a force for good.
Amazing. Well, I know we won't give away too much about the book, but it sounds like that's really a part that you hope readers look forward to, is the chapters of the Radical 11 and how the most important step in moving towards a purpose-driven sports ecosystem, and just learning from that. Are there any other teasers or insights that you would be comfortable sharing from the book, and maybe more about that future-looking aspect in terms of what you're hoping to see in the future of sport for development and peace, and what leaders should really be thinking about?
Yeah, I think that what comes through most strongly from the contributions is the need for representation in the sports ecosystem. So the 11 people wrote their chapters in isolation. They didn't consult with each other. They all wrote their own chapters. They were sent to us, and then but they were all really well aligned, a lot of their messaging, and particularly around this need for having representation in the sports ecosystem. And I think we can think about that representation in a number of ways. And most obviously, I think, in terms of decision making within the football industry. So, for example, within the ownership of clubs, within federations of sports. So, for example, Moya Dodd wrote a wonderful chapter, and she talks about her experiences of being one of the first women on the board of FIFA, and the enormous challenges that she faced in having a voice, even sort of then, and the need to further improve things. And then also the role that athletes can play in decision making in sport. And we had a chapter from Jonas Bear Hoffman, who's head of FIFA Pro. He wrote a chapter on creating a new democracy in football, which has human needs at the center, ensuring that athletes are the drivers of the sport, and which affects, you know, their day-to-day lives. But also thinking about representation more basically in terms around participation. And so another contributor was Kalida Papau, who wrote a really powerful and moving chapter about her experiences as a female footballer in Afghanistan and in growing women's football in Afghanistan. And she put forward an idea of everybody football. So a game that is, in contrast to material football, which is the industry, a game that's for everybody, everywhere and at every level of the sport. And then kind of in parallel to that, Tom Vernon wrote a chapter. So Tom Vernon, the founder of Right to Dream, amazing organization. He was considering representation and participation at the highest level of football at the World Cup, and spoke about structural racism. That means Europe has 13 places at the World Cup, whereas Africa has 5, despite both continents having a similar number of countries. Yeah. And how do we challenge that? And some amazing ideas put forward about how we do that. So can we have we need quotas on boards to make sure there's proper representation of marginalized groups. Tom spoke about potentially having a reparatory fund to address some of the colonial injustices, so that funds within football are channeled back into countries that have been exploited. And then finally, Pamela Coke Hamilton, who's the executive director of the International Trade Center, wrote a chapter about the expansion of Common Goals 1% concept. So could that 1% concept be applied to every player transfer? Could those funds then be sent to the countries from which players are coming to Europe to help them develop for the long term? So all of those amazing ideas really felt like they came back to mostly to one thing, which was representation. If we change the homogenous nature of many of the boards that exist within sport, the decisions will start to change as well, and football will become a more purpose-driven vehicle.
That's amazing. And it sounds so simple, right, Steve? Like, just change the representation, just change the voting structures and things will improve. I mean, are there... realistically, what's your hope or what's your expectation for the sports industry to transforming these recommendations into reality?
Well, there's miles to go, obviously. There's massive challenges within football club level and at federation and confederation level as well. But really, the people within that book put forward their ideas, and I think there's a lot there, the things I mentioned, that we can tap into and drive for change. And I think by working together, our voice is stronger. And that's really one of the messages of the book, of radical collaboration, is that if we can speak together, we can challenge things and we can change things. And then I think the Radical 11 example shows that there are people out there doing that, but what we maybe haven't got is that collaboration. So how do we tie together all of those different activities and voices that are happening to make that to amplify the message that we want to communicate?
Do you think those solutions are good for business as well?
Yeah, well, 100%. Yeah. Yep. There's something in the book, which is in one of the chapters, which Katia Kraus says. I'll try and just find it now and read it out to you. It has long since ceased to be a matter of courtesy to allow women to participate. It is an economic necessity. In the future, diversity will be a competitive advantage and good governance will be the differentiator. They're quite powerful.
Nice. You're quick. You've got the quotes ready. Thanks for that, Steve. And I'm not asking because I don't think it's good for business. I just anticipate some of the traditional critics out there, just like social impact good for business. No, like it is. Read Radical Football.
Yeah, in fact, another chapter that really puts that forward is Preeti. So Preeti Shetty, who is the first Asian woman on the board of a Premier League football club at Brentford. She writes a great chapter about diversity and representation being the future of successful business within sport and more generally in business as a whole.
Did you know you were going to call it Radical Football?
No, that happened halfway through. Well, I think it had about 4 or 5 different names. And then we eventually came upon Radical Football as an analogy of total football, which is a way of playing the game that was pioneered initially by Dutch teams in the 1970s, about all of the players within the team having a very clear role of working together and a philosophy for playing the game that kind of resonated. So radical football is total football, but off the pitch. It's about how the game is run and governed.
Now that we know more about our guest's career journey, the rest of our conversation will allow us to have some fun and get to know our guest on a personal level through some rapid-fire questions. We'll then start to wrap up with pointed questions focused on advice and how our listeners can transform interest into action. Enjoy the rest of the conversation. Steve, who is your sports team?
So I've got to say Kick for Life FC. I'd be in trouble if I didn't say that. But in terms of beyond Kick for Life, it would be Southampton FC, which is the club in England, my local team when I grew up. And yeah. I grew up close to the ground. I could hear when a goal was scored and the crowd went wild. Goodness. So yeah, that's my team.
All of your world travels, is there one city that really stands out to you?
Yeah, I'd say the most beautiful city I've been to is probably Florence. Mm-hmm. But the one that I think I always never tire of, despite it being the one I go to most, would be London, yep. Which maybe is a bit boring because I'm from England, but because I know so much about the history of London, having studied it and being interested in it and reading lots of books, Charles Dickens books. Every time I go there, there's something new that I see or an interesting street name that I can look up and find out a bit more about it. So having that depth of relationship with the city, I don't know if you can have that, but certainly London is what a city that I love.
What's your favorite food?
Loads of different things I could mention, but I think I'm gradually moving towards vegetarianism under the influence of my daughter. So if I had to pull out a dish, I'd say something like stir-fried tofu with ginger and honey, rice, plenty of soy sauce, and a large glass of Argentinian Malbec to wash it down.
Well, I was going to say she'll be proud of your answer, at least the first half. So do you have a favorite hobby outside of sport?
A favorite, I'm not sure, but loads of hobbies. So I'm quite into genealogy, family history. I'm into like sports. So I do a lot of running and reading and travel. Yeah.
And then finally, I understand you've got a few pets. Can you describe any of them and if they're amazing?
Yeah, we've got a golden retriever, Margot, who is, lovely, and three cats as well. So they're quite a harmonious relationship, surprisingly, between the cats and the dog. Between the cats themselves, not so much.
Well, Steve, you've given some amazing insights. I would love to ask you for advice and maybe what advice you would give to somebody listening out there who's really interested in breaking into this sport for development sector. What might you say to them?
Yeah, so firstly, think about why it is you want to go into sport for development in the first place. And most of the people I meet have an interest in sport or a passion for sport, and they have a passion for development. But you don't necessarily need to have a passion for sport in itself, I don't think. And some of the most effective and driven people that I've met in sport for development have a recognition that sport is an effective tool, but their passion is really development. So don't rule yourself out if you're not necessarily a sports fanatic. And also to think about how best you can contribute. So the obvious thing is maybe I could be a coach or I could set up my own project, but sport for development organizations need people with lots of different areas of expertise and finance, HR, administration. So what are the skills that you've got that could contribute most effectively, I guess, to the industry?
In terms of building a social enterprise or building a sport for good organization, it really sounds like your and Pete's decision to do it in a location where it didn't exist was key, or one key. Is that an attribute you would recommend to others?
I don't think it has to be. And I think it's harder now because when we did it, sport for development wasn't so widespread. And now it's all over the world, really. And there's still probably some places where new projects could be set up for the first time. But I think more importantly is to have a clear purpose for the organization and a clear methodology and the energy and passion to get it up and running.
Yeah, that's another thing I've heard you say a few times, the energy and passion. I know that wasn't an end-all be-all, right? You had the skills to back it up. You were doing loads of work, putting in all of the effort to build those relationships and provide a good product, if you will. But just being passionate about it, being able to tell your story and justify why this matters is something that sounds like was quite important.
Yeah, I think for anybody to set up any kind of business or charity or enterprise takes a lot of hard work, especially if you haven't got a starting pot of money that you can use. You've got to start from scratch. Then, you've got to be passionate about it.
Where can people learn more about social enterprise in the development sector or in the business sector? Are there any resources that you'd recommend that you're aware of?
So they can get in touch with us for a start. So we've
Perfect.
Got website Social Enterprise Assist, which includes case studies and other examples of how it can work effectively. But yeah, if they're really interested, get in touch and we can hopefully support them.
My final question that I love to ask all of my amazing guests is, who or what inspires you?
So I think normal people really, who've had the courage to step up and challenge the way things are. So for example, Rosa Parks in the US, not giving up her seat on the bus is a big one. People who've overcome adversity, thinking Stephen Hawking, who despite his enormous challenges related to his disability has fulfilled his academic potential amazingly. And then another example that I saw the other day was a footballer called Stan Cullis. It was when the Gary Lineker story was coming out a few weeks ago. I read this story about Stan Cullis, who was an England player in 1938, and England were playing Germany in Berlin. And it was decided under pressure from Germany that the English FA decided that the players would do the Nazi salute. And he was the one player that refused. Obviously, a really tough position for those players, but he was the one player who refused to do it and was dropped for it. But that was his stand against the regime. So that's moving. And in terms of sport for development, it's people, I think, founders who've set up their organizations despite enormous challenges. So I talked about it being hard setting up Kick for Life, but that doesn't really compare to people who've done it from a position of marginalization or disadvantage. So for example, Ashok, who's the founder of Oscar Foundation in India, overcoming poverty to set up the organization. And my colleague Puki in Lesotho, who is the founder of the women's team at Kick for Life. They're certainly people who inspire me and drive me forward.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much for your time today, sharing a little bit more about the story of Kick for Life and what radical football is. I really appreciate it.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Erica.
Cheers. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Inspira podcast with Erica Mueller Chen. I really hope you enjoyed the episode and found it useful. Be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. Specifically, my link tree is there with tons of awesome information. Feel inspired to take action today? I've got 3 action steps you can take right now because you know your girl likes calls to action and the number 3. So here goes. Number 1, sign up for my mailing list by adding your email address. Number 2, check out my global resource hub and send it to someone in the sector who may be interested. Number 3, buy me a coffee. Or, if you know me, this will actually be a hot cocoa. Your support will help make sure this passion project prospers. All of these links are available by visiting my link tree. Until next time, stay inspired.